and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, thousands of Central American migrants have entered southern Mexico on their way to the United States, despite President Trump's exhortations that they are, quote, criminals, unquote. The president also threatened to cut off aid to any country associated with the caravan and not working hard enough to stop it. It appears that Donald Trump and the Republicans are, in fact, happy about this event and are trying to manipulate the optics for their own political benefit. Next, today we begin a daily segment on politics that will run until Election Day on November 6th. We'll tell you about the closest and most important races around the country and the issues that affect those races. Then, the story behind the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi continues to become more and more bizarre every day. Turkish authorities released a photograph yesterday of a man who apparently had been part of the team that killed Khashoggi, leaving the Saudi consulate wearing the victim's clothes. Meanwhile, Turkish President Erdogan says that he will release in the next 48 hours all of the information his government has collected in the case. That is sure to be a major embarrassment to the Saudi government. President Trump's critics have spent the past 17 months anticipating what some expect to be among the most thrilling events of their lives. Special counsel Robert Mueller's final report on Russian intervention in the 2016 presidential election, but they'll likely be disappointed. At least that's what Politico is hearing from defense attorneys working on the probe and other experts. Meanwhile, a Russian woman has been charged in federal court in the Eastern District of Virginia for allegedly trying to influence the upcoming midterm elections by creating fake Facebook accounts. And finally, today, we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the migrant caravan. Thousands of Central American migrants have entered southern Mexico on their way to the United States, despite President Trump's exhortations that they are, quote, criminals, unquote. The president also threatened to cut off aid to any country associated with the caravan and not working hard enough to stop it. It appears that Donald Trump and the Republicans are, in fact, happy about the caravan and are trying to manipulate the optics for their own political benefit. We're joined from Los Angeles by Juan José Gutiérrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Juan José, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me, John and Brian.
Juan José, Brian and I were talking about this before we began recording this segment. And as crazy as it might sound at first glance, this might be a good thing politically for Donald Trump. It allows him to rally his base. He goes back to the Donald Trump that he was in late 2016 and early 2017, calling Latinos criminals, immigrants criminals, and yelling about his wall, complaining that Democrats have been blocking attempts to strengthen immigration laws in the Congress, which is just simply not true. It's factually incorrect. And this may be good for him politically. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, John, I think that there is, at this point, no doubt whatsoever that this immigrant caravan is a blessing in disguise for the Republican Party congressional cause in November. I believe that this caravan, this immigrant caravan, has become and has been transformed into one giant political commercial for congressional Republicans trying to get reelected and retain control of Congress. Because everything you said in your introduction is true. This immigrant caravan advancing from the south to the north to the U.S.-Mexican border, you know, it's doing the job of rallying the Republican base, once again rebranding undocumented immigrants as criminals, and is making the argument to build a U.S.-Mexico border wall for Donald Trump. And then, of course, it allows Donald Trump and the Republicans to directly attack the Democrats and blame them for the state of chaos of our immigration policy as far as they see it. So no doubt about it, this is great news for the Republicans. you know, who are down, depending on which figures you want to believe, by 5-9 percentage points. They're below the Democrats in public support going into the November 6th election. So, like I said, as far as I'm concerned, this caravan, with every passing hour, becomes a blessing in disguise for the Republican candidates running to retain control of Congress and for Donald Trump.
Juan Jose, with that said, you know, we've talked with you and others in the past, people who are immigrant rights advocates, and we've talked about the human plight of the people who are making up the caravan. The caravan appears, you know, we're outside of it. We're far away from it. But it appears that it has an organic, you know, sort of an organic quality. In other words, people are joining it spontaneously. It becomes, in a way, a demonstration from people who are poor, who are suffering, who are saying, look, we're not going to be invisible. We're empowered by the strength, the slogan, and the chant of the caravan is, we are workers, we are not criminals. Obviously, responding to Trump's agitation, his agitprop against the caravan. And at the same time, because of the way the media is treating it, it is, as you said, being completely used by the Republican parties to make the image of, like, the hordes from Latin America descending on America's border, like they're going to be crashing through the gates, which of course is not true. People would have to be processed for asylum claims. In other words, it would become very orderly. I'm just wondering, given what you said in the beginning about how this is actually playing out in terms of politics, do you think that the organizers of the caravan are aware of how this is impacting American politics? And if so, is it such that that's just not their priority? They don't care? Some people are even suggesting that there might be manipulation going on. Anyway, talk about that if you would.
There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that there is mass manipulation going on in the putting together of what started out as a very small caravan, which is now exploded and has grown to over, according to the latest reports, to more than 7,000 adults and their children moving into Mexico and beginning to make the long march north to the U.S. Mexico border. And why do I say, Brian, that there's no doubt in my mind that there is manipulation? Well, you know, we have to go back to 2009 in June when Honduran then President Manuel Zelaya was deposed in a coup d'etat. We all remember that then President Barack Obama had just come into office, making all sorts of promises and raising progressives' expectations that we could count on him to bring about significant political reform. And one of those would be the U.S. political relationships with Latin America and other countries around the world. Well, you know, the June 2009 Central American coup in Honduras put those expectations to rest. You know, dictator Roberto Micheletti took over for about a year, and then we've had three other presidents ever since. And so, you know, what we have is a very docile, submissive government in Honduras that went out of its way to repress the Honduran workers and peasants and students who were demonstrating in support of bringing about needed reforms in that poor and repressed Central American sister nation. And then all of a sudden, you know, we move up to 2018. We know that now Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez is a puppet of the U.S. How he was imposed in the last presidential elections. I mean, there was major fraud in that election. There's no doubt about it. And here you have these thousands of Hondurans allowed, you know, to congregate first, get themselves organized, and start marching, pre-announcing their plans to come all the way to the United States with the government of that country, fully aware that at least rhetorically, Donald Trump and his administration were going to condemn this effort and use it for their own political benefit, which, as we see now, they're doing. So it's very suspicious that in a country known for major harsh repression against its own population, they would allow the marshaling of forces of this caravan, which I repeat has now grown to over 7,000 people. And the same goes for El Salvador and Guatemala. Now they're in Mexico. And so, you know, we have to be very suspicious that although we don't have, as you said, Brian, you know, tangible evidence that what I'm saying is in fact based on fact, because, we're so far removed from where this caravan is and how it all came about. But I think that we have circumstantial evidence, very strong political evidence that something is fishy here and that there's a lot of manipulation to benefit the political ends of the Republican Party.
Oh, you are exactly right. And nobody is talking about that. Just like nobody is talking about the work that the U.S. did to block the democratically elected president of Honduras from taking office.
That's right.
So you have a servant. You have a servant government, a servile government to the United States, and a repressive government allowing this thing to take off, to gather steam. If they had wanted to stop it, Juan Jose, could they have stopped it? 30 seconds left.
Oh, no question about it. They could have stopped it dead on its tracks. We wouldn't have this so-called emergency national crisis in the United States, which of course it's not. But that's not the situation that we have. And I think that this drama is just getting started.
Okay, that was Juan Jose Gutierrez. He joined us from Los Angeles and is the director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. There's a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we begin a daily segment on politics that will run until Election Day on November 6th. We'll tell you about the closest and most important races around the country and the issues that affect those races. Brian, a lot's being made this election season of the issue of immigration. There's a caravan of refugees and other migrants we already discussed heading to the southern border, and that has the potential to affect several different races, most particularly the Senate races in Arizona and Nevada, and the House race in Texas's 23rd district, which has the longest border with Mexico of any district in America. I want to start with this Senate race in Nevada. This is Senator Dean Heller, who is supposed to be the weakest incumbent Republican in the entire country. This was supposed to be a gimme for the Democrats. But the latest polls run this weekend in Politico and The Hill and a couple of other places show that Hispanic voters in Nevada are breaking conservative this year for whatever reason. And Democrats are having trouble getting their own Hispanic base to get interested in this race.
Yeah, well, every state, John, has its own particularity, its own specific sort of phenomena and its own life. But no state exempt from or immune from or outside the context of the larger political situation in the country. And you can feel momentum actually shifting on a national basis, at least in response to some of the big political issues, because mm-hmm. they dominate the media. And where does public mood or public consciousness derive from? It derives largely from the mainstream media still, sadly. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about why this could possibly be happening in Nevada. You have the Trump administration clearly, as we talked about in our last segment, manipulating in some ways or using the optics of the caravan coming through Mexico from Honduras and Central America to mobilize the base of the Republican Party. In this case, people would think, well, that means white people,
right?
White people in Midwestern states. There is a more complex phenomena within the Latino populations, which is not a monolithic grouping.
That's
obviously,
right.
It's not one nationality. People are Latino in America. They're called Latino, but some are from Mexico, some are from Honduras, some are from El Salvador, some are from all over Latin America, or from even other countries, including continental Europe. Let's talk about how this could possibly be playing out in Nevada.
Well, one of the things that's interesting to me about Nevada and specifically about Las Vegas is that Las Vegas is a heavily populated Democratic bastion in what is otherwise a Republican state. Las Vegas is heavily unionized, And most of the Latino workers in Las Vegas, especially those who work in the casinos, are union members. Now, I would assume that a lot of those union members would be a little bit wary of more people coming across the border looking for work because it could threaten their own jobs, especially if they're doing things like working in hotels, let's say, or working in the service industry in Las Vegas. I can see where they might be a little worried about immigration. When the Democrats make an assumption that Latinos are Democrats or Latinos are progressives, I think that's a mistake. I think that the Democrats need to pay more attention to issues that are important to Latino voters, and I think they need to react to those issues.
Let me just introduce another possible explanation, which is the Latino voter turnout might be suppressed or repressed or just low because people who have, let's say, immigrant families.
That's right.
Some people are citizens. Some people
are
not citizen. There's been a lot of voter ID issues. I just wonder whether there's also fear from some parts of the Latino community of coming out and voting. You know, just like we saw where Latino families were asked to come to the border by the Trump administration and say, well, if there's children who are part of your family and their parents have been deported or they're locked up, come and get them. And then people show up there. And there's, in fact, you know, people are taking IDs and some of those family members are being arrested. I just wonder whether there could be a fear factor.
Oh, I think there is. I think you're right.
Yeah, I'm looking at an article from the Nevada Independent, and the headline is, and this is from today, despite growing numbers, Latino turnout in midterm election is uncertain. With 2 weeks left before the midterm elections, more Latinos in Nevada and around the nation are eligible to vote than ever before, but speculation varies to whether they will actually show up to the polls, a scenario that has also kept the political parties guessing in past midterms. According to a report from the Pew Research Center, 29 million Latinos will be able to participate in these 2018 midterm elections, including 387,000 in Nevada. That's 19% of all of eligible state voters in Nevada. And yet it looks like Latino voter turnout may be in question, according to this article. Makes sense to you?
It makes perfect sense to me. I think there is an element of fear, especially in the political environment that we find ourselves in with Donald Trump in the White House screaming about Latinos and about refugees and about immigrants almost every single day. Let's switch quickly, Brian, to the Arizona Senate race. Now, I think we're seeing the opposite thing happening in Arizona. Arizona has been an historically conservative state. For whatever reason, Democrats seem to have a new breath of life in really both of the Senate races that are taking place there. One because of the death of John McCain. But the one that's really important is the race to replace Jeff Flake. Now, there's a poll that came out recently, like just in the last day or so on this race, showing a congresswoman, the Democratic nominee, that's Congresswoman Kristen Sinema, being 5 points ahead of her Republican opponent, Congresswoman Martha McSally. This has been a race that really everybody has been focused on because it's two women, because no woman has ever represented Arizona in the United States Senate, and because this really is a referendum in part on the immigration issue. Also, I think that there might be a backlash this time against the conservatives because you have former Tea Party members. You've got McSally, who was one of the first members of Congress to endorse Donald Trump for president. You have Joe Arpaio, who had run in the Republican primary and lost, but making a very big stink about refugees and immigrants. And so I think that what we're seeing in Arizona might be the opposite of what we're seeing in Nevada, where the Democrats have a better chance of winning if they embrace the issue of immigration.
Talk about how the media impacts Arizona. The Arizona Republic is backing the Democrat, Sinema, in her contentious Senate race against Martha McSally. Is that a surprising? What kind of paper is the Atlantic Republic?
A big surprise. The Arizona Republic is the largest paper in the state and it is a Republican paper. It's always been known as a Republican paper, although it backed Hillary Clinton in 2016. That was the first time in the newspaper's century-long history that it had ever backed a Democrat for president. Well, it's backing the Democrat in this Senate race. I think that's a very big deal because there are a lot of suburban and exurban voters that look to this newspaper for guidance, more so than other newspapers. And it's because there are so many retirees in the greater Phoenix area. I think this is going to be a major endorsement. And in our last couple of minutes, I wanted to address a House race. This is Texas's 23rd district. It's represented by a moderate Republican. He might dispute the term moderate, but Will Hurd. Will is an old colleague of mine from the CIA. I was actually his mentor when he first joined the CIA. Very good guy, as honest as the day is long. But when push comes to shove, he votes with his party's leadership. And so his voting record in Congress is probably a little more conservative than he really is personally. Now, he's walking a very fine line on this immigration issue. Texas's 23rd district, it looks like the country of Chile. It's very long and very narrow, and it just hugs the U.S.-Mexican border. It has the longest border with Mexico of any congressional district in America. So this was a Supreme Court-mandated majority Hispanic district. It had a Hispanic congressman for one term for 2 years, and then Will ran against him in a Republican year and won. Now, Will is an African-American congressman, one of a very, very few African-American Republicans in Congress. But again, it's in this majority Hispanic district. Well, his opponent on the Democratic side is a woman who is a bona fide war hero, but she's openly gay and she is Filipino-American. So this district was supposed to be very conventional. It was supposed to be an Hispanic Republican running against an Hispanic Democrat. And that just has never happened. So we're going to have to watch this race vis-a-vis immigration. Well, we're out of time for this segment, but we will continue, as I said, to look at these issues every day between now and November 6th. We're going to talk about the closest races in the country and the issues that are affecting those races. In the meantime, you are listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The story behind the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi continues to become more and more bizarre every day. Turkish authorities released a photograph yesterday of a man who apparently had been part of the team that killed Khashoggi, leaving the Saudi consulate wearing the victim's clothes. Meanwhile, Turkish President Erdogan says that he will release in the next 48 hours all of the information his government has collected in the case. That is sure to be a major embarrassment for the Saudi government. We're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. He is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Welcome back, Mohammed.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mohammed, it seems to me that if you want to kill a political opponent in a foreign country, you walk up to him on the street and kill him and make it look like a mugging. Why in the world would the Saudis lure him into their consulate, torture him, murder him, cut off his fingers, chop him up, send somebody out wearing his clothes, then deny that they did anything, then admit that they did it, but it was the result of a fist fight?
Did you ever see the Pink Panther or the Return of the Pink Panther?
This is Inspector Clouseau.
We can't make heads or tails out of it, Mohammed. Can you?
No. I simply don't understand what this is all about. And I don't understand the latest revelation where a body double left the consulate. What purpose does that serve? Who knows? But there is something that makes it, for me at least, a bit more understandable, and that is the pattern that we've been seeing since Mohammed bin Salman came to power. He launched a horrific war against Yemen. He's failed in this war. It's destroying the Saudi resources, and still he won't quit the war. He kidnapped a foreign prime minister. With hindsight, I think Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon, should be thankful that he wasn't butchered. He goes and creates a siege against Qatar overnight, the same country that was allied with him, his country, the previous king, in their support for ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Jaish al-Islam and other extremist groups in Syria and Iraq. And in addition, right after the first meeting of investors in Riyadh last year, the Davos in the Desert, as it's now called, which was held in the Ritz, the very next week, after having all these international investors, he turns the very same hotel into a prison for princes, hundreds of princes and billionaires. And you'd imagine that all those investors who were in the hotel the previous week would think twice before ever coming back to the country. So when you have this sort of irrational behavior that has been existent since this young person has come to power, then this act sort of makes sense within that context, this craziness, this irrational and brutal behavior, this ISIS-like murder sort of falls within that pattern.
You know, one of the things, too, that surprises me is how there doesn't seem to be any reaction from people in Saudi Arabia, especially other princes. You would expect something to leak out. But I wonder if Mohammed bin Salman has been so successful in silencing critics inside his own family with those arrests that you mentioned at the Ritz-Carlton, that no one dares raise a voice against him. You know, here in the United States, we have members of both parties in Congress speaking very strongly, very forcefully against Mohammed bin Salman right now, thinking that, you know, maybe it's time for him to go. Maybe it's time for Mohammed bin Nayef to be crown prince again. And you're getting none of that from Saudi Arabia.
I think the family is too intimidated. It is an absolute monarchy, and it is a brutal regime. If you recall, the person who cut up the body with a bone saw, he told the people there to listen to music, and that he does it. He listens to music when he does this. That basically means this isn't the first time that he's done this before.
You're exactly right.
This is a country, this is a regime that treats its citizens outside the country in such a horrific manner, let alone citizens that are within its borders. So I can understand why people are intimidated. Right now, a young woman and her husband are both on death row, or they may go beyond death row. That's what the prosecutor is looking for, because they simply filmed the brutality of the Saudi regime in during protests in eastern Saudi Arabia. All they did was put some footage on Facebook.
Let's talk about who Khashoggi is, who his family is. His uncle, of course, is the famous Adan, who was so involved in the key middleman in the Iran-Contra.
And actually, he was, at the time, the richest man in the world.
Yeah, he was the arms...
As an arms dealer.
Arms dealer. His father was the personal doctor for the king of Saudi Arabia. Highly, highly connected family. And let's talk about Jamal. What's his history? He's not an opposition figure. He's not a dissident. He's a loyalist. He's connected to different factions of the Saudi royal family, Mohammed. I mean, again, he's not trying to overthrow or topple the Saudi monarchy. So what was it that drew Mohammed bin Salman's ire, and why did he feel, or did he, I mean, is it just recklessness or fecklessness or youthfulness or whatever you want to call it, or was there some sort of existential threat to Mohammed bin Salman's rule from inside the Saudi royal family that he's most worried about?
No, I don't think that there was any real threat. I knew Jamal. I've known him for more than 10 years. We've been on TV together on numerous occasions, in studio and also through satellite, and we've been together at different mini conferences on multiple occasions in different countries, including in the city of Istanbul. The last time I debated with him actually was on an RT program called Crosstalk. This was about 11 months ago after he had left Saudi Arabia. He was a staunch defender of Saudi Arabia, by the way, for many years. He was their most effective defender, defending the what I believe is indefensible position. But he worked very hard to defend them. He was very well funded by them. That's how he became famous, because the Saudis provided him with very good funding. He knew all the key think tank people, all the major journalists in the United States. And that's one of the reasons why this backfired, because all these influential and well-known people, it would be very difficult for them to remain quiet after such a death. But Jamal always defended the regime to the hilt. And even after he left Saudi Arabia, he criticized certain elements of Mohammed bin Salman's policies, but he defended others. The last time I was on that Crosstalk show with him, he was trying to defend Saudi Arabia when he was abroad. And in fact, near the end of the program, it's on YouTube, I told him that, you know, you're trying so hard to defend Saudi Arabia, yet you can't go home and your life isn't, you're threatened. Your safety is threatened. That was the irony, that this person, despite the fact that he was being punished, that he wasn't allowed to write, and that he had to ultimately leave the country, he was still defending it. He never called for the overthrow of Mohammed bin Salman or the Saud family, and he owes everything that he has to that family. But that's how Mohammed bin Salman treats people. He's ruthless, and he has no real friends. And I think this is what will bring about his downfall, because on the one hand, he is betraying the people who carried out this murder by blaming them for a rogue operation. This basically will be a message to everyone that they cannot trust Mohammed bin Salman. On the other hand, he can't step down either, can he? Because if Mohammed bin Salman steps down, he'll be killed. He has so many enemies in the royal family that he won't last long. So in power, he can't trust anyone, because no one can trust him. Out of power, I think he's dead meat. So he's in an impossible situation. And as long as he is in power, Saudi Arabia is going to be facing many difficulties. I don't think any world leader would like to have a photo op with him, travel to Saudi Arabia, or to invite him to their country.
30 seconds left. I know you don't have a crystal ball, Mohammed. Can you envision him being put out of power anytime soon?
That's a good question. I don't think he's going to last, but what exactly does that mean? I don't know, whether weeks, months, or years, but this is the end of Mohammed bin Salman as a powerful leader, and I think this is the beginning of the decline of the Saudi regime.
Wow, you heard it here first. Well, we'll leave it there. We were joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. Mohammed is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Donald Trump's critics have spent the last 17 months anticipating what some expect will be among the most thrilling events of their lives. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's final report on Russian 2016 election interference. But they may be in for a disappointment. At least that's the word Politico got from defense lawyers working on the Russia probe and more than 15 former government officials with investigation experience spanning Watergate to the 2016 election. In the meantime, a Russian woman has been charged in federal court in the Eastern District of Virginia for allegedly trying to influence the upcoming midterm elections by creating fake social media accounts. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
So there are a couple of issues here.
The Politico headline is funny. Mueller Report PSA. That's
public service announcement.
Public service announcement. Mueller Report PSA. Prepare for disappointment.
It's going to end up being a big fat nothing burger. to use the FBI's words.
I'm so disappointed. All of this? And they're saying even not only this, a big part of the report will never be made available to the public. It's going to be sealed.
Yeah, it'll be sealed.
I mean, after Daniel Lazar, after spending not just millions and tens of millions of dollars, but the political focus of the country for 2 years, now they might not release their findings?
Yeah, it's possible that'll happen. I mean, everybody's hoping that Mueller will somehow save the day, will rescue the Democrats from their own incompetence. But they should brace themselves. It may not happen. A lot of things could happen. There may be no report. It may be heavily redacted. Or what it has to say could be so equivocal that it really would amount to not very much. I've always maintained, I've been very skeptical of the whole Russiagate angle from the beginning. I'm with Oleg Deripaska, if that's his correct name, the Russian oligarch who was approached by the FBI for help in investigating the Russia angle. And Deripaska told the FBI that the very idea of collusion was, quote, preposterous, unquote. And I'm with him. I don't think that Trump had any help from Putin. I think he did it all by himself, due to his own special talents.
Wait! You forgot CBS. They said they gave him free press coverage because it was, quote, good for ratings. And CNN, Zucker said we had a problem, but Donald Trump solved it. Lots of free media coverage, but guess what? You know what? The masses of people, John, did not tune in.
No.
To Loud and Clear.
No, they should have.
And if they had, they would have heard us trashing Donald Trump throughout the 2016 campaign.
Yes, but that didn't mean that he colluded with the Russians.
No,
but and Trump is a very talented guy in certain respects, and he's not totally stupid. The Democrats have consistently underestimated him. Bear in mind, of course, Hillary did win the election in the only way that counts, but Trump deprived her of sufficient votes to overcome the built-in disadvantage in the Electoral College. But there's just no evidence of any sort that Russia had a hand in this. I mean, there are a few Facebook ads by an entity with some distant connection to the Kremlin, but they were so minor. $46,000 worth of ads by election day that it just seems absurd to suggest that this is in any way decisive. And the latest indictment of this Russian woman who was accused of placing other ads of a politically indecipherable nature is equally unimpressive. I mean, she's sowing discord, but what does sowing discord even mean, especially in a society as discordant as the United States?
Yeah, the indictment of this 44-year-old woman in St. Petersburg, Elena Kushyainova. She's actually an accountant, John.
Yeah.
She's an accountant for a number of companies, and she obviously won't ever appear in court, which
no.
Mueller doesn't want her to come to court because
then there's
they'd have discovery and find out what the underlying thing is.
And let me ask you a question. I need to interrupt you for a second, Brian. You read this complaint. I didn't read the complaint, but in none of the articles about this indictment, do they actually say what the crime is?
Well, it's when you read it, it's as thin as gruel. I don't know if people actually still know what gruel is, but I have the complaint in front of me. Citing an online, this is like these Facebook ads. This is what tipped the scales, or this was for the midterm elections, trying to tip the scales. Citing an online news article titled "Maryland City Mulling Over Idea to Let Illegal Immigrants Vote," from on or about August 7th, 2017, a member of the conspiracy, that's Elena, the 44-year-old accountant, directed that the article be messaged in the following way: stress that the leadership in sanctuary cities has lost all connection with reality and is trying to provide criminals who illegally cross the U.S. border with voting rights that are available only to U.S. citizens of the United States. Okay, so that would be like traditional right-wing Republican,
sure,
ridiculous propaganda. And then here's the next crime of the conspiracy. Citing an online news article, again, entitled "Dobbs Slams McConnell Says It's Time to Ditch Mitch," from on or about August 8th. It's hard not to laugh at this. From on or about August 8th, 2017, a member of the conspiracy, Elena the accountant, directed that the article be messaged in the following way. It's time for Mitch McConnell to retire.
Oh, my God.
I mean, like, with this kind of overwhelming impact on American voters.
And it seems, too, that the prosecution took offense to another article that she apparently shared entitled The 8 Dirtiest Scandals of Robert Mueller No One Is Talking About.
Yeah.
It's a criminal act.
Yeah. They're sowing discord. Here's another one. In or around, it's hard not to read from this criminal complaint.
I just want to interject that I personally am totally persuaded by this evidence to go out and vote for Donald Trump immediately.
Yes. In or around, again, criminal complaint for Elena, in or around May 15, 2015, the conspiracy created a Facebook account registered under the false U.S. persona Helen Christopherson. On her Facebook page, Helen Christopherson purported to be a resident of New York City and identified her hometown as Charleston, South Carolina. And then Helen Christopherson contacted individuals and groups in the United States to promote protests, rallies, and marches, including funding, advertising, flyers, and rally supplies. Again, this was about the Charlottesville rally. No. None of this could potentially have any impact. I'd say, Daniel Lazar, this indictment of this 44-year-old accountant, part of the conspiracy for the midterm elections, is really just to create news. It's really to create the idea, the sense that really the conspiracy is being exposed step mm-hmm. by step. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one person. She's an accountant. She lives in St. Petersburg. She opened up, according to this, she didn't open up, but she paid others who opened up false Facebook pages, which we know, by the way, trolling farms do this all over the world.
All the time.
Over the world.
Yes. And I don't know if you're following it, but one of the Concord management entities that were in this part of the same St. Petersburg complex that were indicted by Mueller is actually fighting this case in court. And one of their arguments is that none of these activities are in any way, you know, conspiratorial, they don't amount to conspiracy towards improper election interference. Even if all the facts are correct, you can, you know, put spoof articles in Facebook. You can open up different accounts under various names. You can do all these things under the First Amendment. I can use a typewriter to dash off a phony article and no one will indict me because that is my right under free speech. This is not rise to a criminal activity.
Certainly not. You know, I have one question too, and this may sound rhetorical, but it's actually not. And this is something that I see in literally every article about this issue. The piece in NBC News, the piece in the Washington Post, all these articles begin with the same thing. A Russian woman who works for an oligarch close to Russian President Vladimir Putin, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, why are only Russians oligarchs? And what do they mean when they say close to Vladimir Putin?
Oligarch,
because they always say that.
Oligarch is a biologically genetic label for people of Russian or Slavic
who have money. Right.
And of course, you're right. There are so many degrees of separation here. It's not funny. I mean, there's no attempt to tie it to Putin himself. And in fact, the indictment of the St. Petersburg companies made no attempt to tie the alleged conspiracy to the Kremlin itself. All we know is the head of these companies is known as a Putin's chef because he's gotten various contracts from the Russian government and may have had some personal association of an unknown nature with Putin over the years. But that does not mean he's in any sense operating at Putin's behest.
No.
You know, it's like the guy who sweeps Donald Trump's floors is not necessarily a Trump associate or someone following orders from Trump. He's a guy who's had some kind of association with Trump in years past, but that's meaningless.
And these ads, according to the conspiracy from the criminal indictment, some of them are pro-Democrat, some of them are pro-Republican. Here's one. Again, a tweet. I don't know. It's Connie Jackson. Again, Elena, the conspiracy. Dear Alabama, you have a choice today. Doug Jones put the KKK in prison for murdering four young black girls. Roy Moore wants to sleep with your teenage daughters. This isn't hard. Hashtag Alabama Senate. That's a pro-Democratic Party
yeah.
ad.
Yeah, sure. And I would have retweeted that if I had seen it.
Yeah, and thus you would have been part of the conspiracy.
That's right.
But what's the point of this conspiracy? Like, people in Alabama know about Roy Moore. They were upset about him. They also know about Doug Jones. They know about the Birmingham church bombing. They know that four young black kids did die. This isn't Russia. This is America. This whole deflection. Anyway, John, we're out of time.
We're out of time.
A horrendous trajectory that we're on.
Just terrible. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country, what's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us. Bill joins us from Chicago. He is an activist, an educator, and the author of the book You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. And you can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Bill, it's always good to have you.
Good to be here. Thanks so much.
Bill, one of the issues that we've been wanting to talk about with you is test-centered or examination-centered education and how unfair that is, especially to students in urban areas. You know, we hear these horror stories about test scores in Baltimore, in Chicago, in Washington, D.C., but there's a lot more to this because these standardized tests are not fair to all children, are they?
Well, they're not. They're culturally biased. And all the research shows that the test score that you get is deeply related to class background, family income, educational level of your parents, and so on. So in many ways, it's a multi-billion dollar industry that does nothing but say, okay, line up against the wall there from poorest to richest, and we'll make a cutoff here. I mean, they really are quite biased, and they don't really indicate much except how you do on a test score. And I want to say more about it, but they are deeply, deeply flawed.
Bill, one of the things that I've never understood, and this is my own fault, but I hope you can put it in plain English for me, is the No Child Left Behind Act. This was bipartisan. It was highly touted by both parties, but it was a failure. Can you talk a little bit about what No Child Left Behind was and why it failed?
Well, No Child Left Behind was an attempt by the federal government. It was put forward by Teddy Kennedy, and it was a bipartisan effort, but it was buying deeply into the notion, to the kind of tenets of corporate school reform, which as I've said before, rests on kind of three legs. One leg is that the way that you can know how a student is doing in school is by a single metric, a high-stakes standardized test score. Now, one of the things that we have to make a distinction of, and this is often a difficult thing in our language, but here we have a situation where standards are very good. Standardization is not so good. And I can give you lots of examples, but one of my favorites is if you're a baseball fan and you watch a shortstop play baseball, you like Schwann Dunstan, you like a number of other people who don't come to my mind immediately. But, you know, you watch these guys, Javi Baez, for example, in the Cubs, and you say, wow, they are playing at a high level. I see that there's a high standard here of what it means to be a shortstop. Interestingly, none of them play shortstop exactly the same. They all do it differently. So it's not standardized, but that doesn't mean we don't have high standards. The problem with the test score is it's a high-stakes standardized test, and what it means is everyone in the school gets bent in the direction of getting a test score because that's the proof of success. This is flawed in so many ways. I'll give you one example. There's a tenet in economics called Goodhart's Law. Goodhart's Law basically says a performance metric only works as a performance metric if you don't use it as a performance metric. What that means, I know it sounds funny and it's a great sentence, rolls right off your tongue, but what it means is that as soon as you say, we're going to know what a good high school is by how this test score gets rendered, then everyone bends towards the test score and the school could remain quite crummy, but on this one metric, which is the one they've chosen, it becomes, you know, the whole story. So a great example in Chicago is that one of our charter schools brags about the fact that 100% of kids go to college. And it's true. 100% of their graduates go to college. And that means it's a good high school, except that it's a terrible high school. They push kids out who aren't going to go to college. Anything counts as a college, Rose's Beauty School and, you know, and so on. And attrition at the universities is massive. So it's not really a good school. They've stripped out the arts. They've stripped out sports. But they've created the conditions where this one metric stands for success. That's always a problem. And I'll pivot one more time. I'm sorry to keep going, but just one more note. And that is this lawsuit that's going on at Harvard, which is really catastrophic for a lot of reasons. But one thing is that they want to insist that there's an objective, measurable way to know who's best. And that objective, measurable way is a standardized test. That leaves out so many dimensions of what it means to be human and what it means to be successful, what it means to be a contributing member of society. And so we're watching this Harvard thing unwind, and all the white supremacist assumptions and so on are all in play. But underneath it all, there's also this sense that a test score is an objective measure of excellence, and it's the gold standard of excellence. And that is false.
Einstein did poorly in math in high school, Bill Ayers.
I knew that. And Einstein also said, everything that matters, you know, everything that matters can't be counted, and everything that counts doesn't matter. So, I mean, you know, you have this irony, which is we've bought into this system, and it's been foisted on us in many ways by, you know, by the corporate lobbyists and so on. And so we all sit here gazing kind of dumbstruck by the power of the standardized test, but they are a classic fraud.
Speaking of Einstein, Bill Ayers, he was a socialist. He wrote the important essay called Why Socialism. I would suggest to everyone who, you know, there's a greater and greater interest in socialism, read Einstein. You can't get smarter than Einstein, even though he did badly at math, but he was smart enough to know that socialism was a good idea. I read that, everyone. But then, speaking of Einstein and socialism, Betsy DeVos was asked whether U.S. schools are teaching kids to be socialists. Her answer was rich. That's a headline from the Washington Post. Can you talk about that, Bill Ayers?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things Betsy DeVos says in her interview there is that we don't spend enough time on civic education and critical engagement, and that's absolutely true. The problem is she believes that civic education is telling people her version of what's true about American history and American society. The reality is that kids on their own, against a massive wall of propaganda, are realizing that when you look around and say, what would be a fair and decent and just way to organize society? Many kids intuitively go to the idea, which is a deeply Christian idea, which is from each according to their ability to each according to their needs.
That's right.
That's not so complicated. It's pretty simple. It's pretty moral. And I remember when Obama ran in 2008, and that was the first time that the polls indicated that young people had a higher opinion of socialism than they did of Republicans. And one of the things I imagined, I laughed imagining, some kid in Iowa, the right wing keeps calling Obama a socialist, and they've never heard of it. So they Google it, socialism. From each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. Sounds great. I'm for it. And I think if you ask a group of kids, imagine the society that you want to live in. Imagine the society that would be fair and just for all. And socialism is the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah, the Washington Post article talks about this poll. It was an August Gallup poll, which, here's the thing, Americans aged 18 to 29 are positive about socialism, 51%. As they are about capitalism, 45%. This represents a 12-point decline in young adults' positive views of capitalism in just 2 years, and a market shift since 2010, when 68% of people in this age group, Americans, viewed capitalism positively. Mm-hmm. 68%. Now it's down to 45%. Meanwhile, young people's views of socialism have fluctuated somewhat from year to year. But the 51% with positive views today is the same as in 2010. You're right. You know, we've had a situation where capitalism is conflated with democracy, socialism is conflated with totalitarianism. And as a consequence, the issue was, do you want to be free? Do you want to be democratic? Or do you want to be authoritarian and probably poorer? because the Soviet Union or other socialist countries came from poorer parts of the world. So that's the way the question has been gauged, Bill Ayers. But now capitalism is being measured against itself, not a poorer, perhaps less attractive element of socialism. And as a consequence, people are thinking, hey, there might be a better way. 1 minute left.
Well, for all the weaknesses in Bernie Sanders' campaign, I think one of the things he did is he made the word socialism palatable again. And I think once people look into it, you're exactly right. The conflation of capitalism with freedom and democracy is an absolute myth. And as capitalism reaches its kind of outer limits, its kind of zombie phase, and you see what it's doing to the environment, and you see how it constructs a society in which homelessness is rampant, hunger is rampant in the most wealthy country in the world, it just boggles your mind. And you say, well, wait, is there an alternative? And indeed, there is. And as I say, Sanders had made lots of mistakes and had a lot of flaws, but he did elevate the word. And now we have candidates running for election all over the country who call themselves socialists. I think that's a positive development. Now let's get serious about talking how we get there.
That's right. Well, that was the voice of Bill Ayers. Bill joined us from Chicago. He is an activist, educator, and the author of the book You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Thank you.